Hey, podcasters, a lot going on today. We're going to start with your grandparents having sex. I mean, it's that uncomfortable. It's Bernie Sanders and his dirty, almost like Penthouse Forum article from 1972. It's really quite disturbing. Then the person that has beaten the Beatles and having the top three songs, 1, 2, and 3, on the Billboard charts at once. Beatles are the only ones that have done it. Until now, of course, we all know who that
is. Oh, you guess it right away without even telling you.
A really amazing story about a woman who lost her husband, 3 children, now don't have a father due to a gunman in an office. Wait until you hear her response, and we kind of want to really make her day.
And when it comes to the Second Amendment, we should point out as well, tonight on television, there is a show about the new way the left is trying to undermine the Second Amendment. It's not one they've tried in the past. Glenn, you've hinted to it before, but it's something that they're doing in the world of finance that is trying to take away your Second Amendment rights. That's on tonight at 5 p.m. Eastern on Glenn's TV show.
Yeah,
you can get it at blazetv.com/Beck, and the promo code is Beck. Will save you $10.
And it's well worth subscribing to and learning. Nobody else is really talking about this. I've been talking about it for 2 years, saying it was coming, and lo and behold, here it is. Also, we talked to Elizabeth Johnston about her day of mourning and something really important. Ocasio-Cortez wearing out her welcome. You will actually feel bad for Ocasio-Cortez when I finish this story, because you're going to see how the Democrats are actually using her. And it is for the fundamental transformation of America. And if we don't know about it and we're not paying attention, it will happen in 2020.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Let me tell you, our sponsor this half hour, our spotlight is Home Title Lock. I love Home Title Lock. This is something that we all really, really believe in because there is only one company that actually stands at the guard, at the gate, if you will, of this new digital world where when your title has to be changed, your house is sold, your title comes in digitally and goes to one central vault that keeps all of the titles. So when it comes in and out of that vault, if you have Home Title Lock, they're watching it and going, wait a minute. The Becks wanted to know.
Did you just sell your house for 50 cents?
Yeah.
Because that's an odd choice.
Yeah, because then they call. Are you selling your house? No. Okay, somebody's committing title fraud on you. This is the fastest growing crime, according to the FBI. Really bad. Get a free check on whether or not this has already happened to you. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. HomeTitleLock.com. Do it now. Bernie Sanders, he knows people, don't you think? I mean, he is one with the people.
He's almost a mind reader, I feel like.
Right? Read this article.
If he were to open up a shop where he read palms, maybe tarot cards.
Yeah, he would be.
He might be able to afford multiple like vacation homes. He'd be that rich.
No, he already has that.
He multiple more vacations.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So Bernie Sanders. Now, remember, this is at a time where if you did anything in the past, if you dressed up with blackface in 1980, you're in trouble.
Right. Even if you did it and not you did it as to in your mind in 1980, compliment Michael Jackson as a Halloween costume.
Mm-hmm. You're in trouble. You're in trouble.
Big trouble. You're thrown out of office.
Right. Well, no, you're a Democrat, so you're not thrown out of office, but
you're targeted for being thrown out of office.
You know what will happen? Cause any trouble,
Republicans will seize on it. That will happen.
They'll seize on it.
The blackface.
Right. Now, 8 years prior to that, not a problem.
So now, the line is 1980?
Well, in Bernie Sanders' case. Okay, and it's not blackface, and maybe that's the catch. He didn't do blackface. He instead wrote this in an editorial. A man goes home, and I'm going to clean this up because I can't read it on air.
Yeah, this is one if you're bringing your kids to school or picking them up or doing. Yeah, you might want to turn this one off.
A man comes. This is beautiful. This
is
so
poetry.
Relatable.
It is poetry.
A man goes home and pleasures himself. his typical fantasy: a woman on her knees, a woman tied up, a woman abused.
Who are this guy's friends? Who does he know?
Maybe I'm out of step with the typical fantasies, but that's not my typical fantasy.
And that's a two-parter. You are, I'm sure, out of step with the typical fantasies.
Let me talk to you about my fantasy. Okay, here's my fantasy. And I know this is like watching grandma and grandpa have sex, but let me just tell you about my typical fantasy. I have this fantasy, and I think this is typical of most people, where, you know, a guy comes home and he's when he gets home, he can really just let loose and he commits genocide on a race. Any race, doesn't matter, as long as it's not the white race.
Okay.
And he starts with women, and they can be of any color. But he doesn't kill, he kills them. Did you see The Hobbit? I call this my Hobbit fantasy. Mm-hmm. You take, starting with women, you go up to Mount Doom. And you go right to that, you know, that precipice where, you know, Frodo and Gollum were wrestling, and Gollum fell into it. I saw that, and I started to pleasure myself a few times just on Gollum. And then I thought, wouldn't it be better if it was a woman or someone of a different race, you know, because they fall into the lava and you can see them. Oh, my gosh. You can see them melt. Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to stop talking about it or I'm just going to get too excited. But I think that's what we all think as men.
I'm going to change my answer. You actually are in step with Bernie Sanders and his fantasies.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, who has
describes them in depth.
Right. So that's a man's fantasy. A woman on her knees, tied up, a woman abused. I don't think that's men's fantasies, abusing women. I don't know who thinks like that.
There's a few. They're mostly in Hollywood. You saw them with a hashtag Me Too next to their names a bunch of times over the past couple of years.
Okay, a woman, and now he goes on to explain women. Now he's probably right in line with women, typical
Bernie
women.
Sanders. I mean, you want to talk ladies, man. You want to talk about a guy who just knows the fairer sex.
Just look at him.
Oh, man, it's Bernie Sanders.
So he says a woman enjoys sexual relations with her man as she fantasizes being raped by three men simultaneously. Yeah. I know my wife is always, she's like, man, if we just had two more guys that were taking me forcefully. No, I don't think so.
No, and just to remind you, we're talking about the words, the actual words written by a young man named Bernard Sanders. He was a young man of 85 at the time. In 1972, this is a guy who is running for president. He's probably the front runner right now in the Democratic Party. He is, by most polling, one of the most popular politicians in America.
And he believes this, at least in 1972, he believed that this was the fantasy of men and women. I mean, this is a guy who, this is why progressives believe there's a rape culture. Because people like this are saying, look, we know what all guys are like. No, Bernie, guys and women, they're not like this.
And Bernie Sanders seems to be thinking there's a rape culture, and if there were, women would be excited about it.
I mean, yes. This
is their fantasy. They're thrilled about the possibility of this happening to them.
Can you imagine? I mean, who can understand the rape victim? Bernie Sanders? Bernie, have you changed your mind about this, and what made you change your mind? Did that change your ways at all? Did that change your actions? What happened to you? This is so terrifying that he believes the typical fantasy is this. Mm-hmm. Even if he says, no, that's not my fantasy, he's projecting that fantasy on the average male.
To be fair, and I know no one would do this for us, and we should at least point this out, that this particular piece was written by Bernard Sanders. We are not entirely sure if Bernard Sanders and Bernie Sanders, I mean, maybe it's an alter ego, a really clever pen name, but Bernard Sanders wrote this in 1972. And so if you see Bernard Sanders' name on a ballot, you may want to pause and think about this op-ed a little bit.
So he talks about, you know, women being tied up, women being abused, women being raped. That's everybody's fantasy. Then he says, you know, then they get dressed up, they go to church or to their revolutionary political meeting. Notice that he says it's they're going to church or their revolutionary political meeting, meaning to me at least, that's the church for the left. Have you ever looked at the Stag, Man, Hero, Tough magazines on the shelf of your local bookstore? No, Bernie, I've never even heard of those magazines.
What bookstore is this guy going to?
Can you look up, Merz, look up Stag magazine or Man magazine, or is it Hero?
Hero, I think it is, right?
Hero or Kiro, yeah, it must be Hero. Tough magazine. Do you know why the newspapers with articles like Girl 12 raped by 14 men sell so well?
What the hell is this guy? I mean, this is beyond.
This is like, this is the stuff that you would say. We went to his Facebook page and he had posted these things. How did we not know? How come this wasn't alerted? How come nobody said what's wrong with this guy? Nobody alerted anybody that he said these were his fantasies? I mean, this is the stuff that would be blocked by the FBI now after you found that he was the killer of some sort of a sex cult.
Yeah, this is the paperwork unearthed in the Ted Bundy tapes documentary.
Exactly right.
Did you know Ted Bundy he wrote this. Can you believe it? Of course you can believe that he did all these things. I mean, and by the way, the next line says, to what in us are they appealing? In us. I mean, he seems to be in some odd way, including himself.
Well, I don't know what Stag, Man, Hero, or Tough magazine is.
But we do know what Girl 12 Raped by 14 Men is.
Yep.
He says, again, this is a quote. Do you know why newspapers with the articles like Girl 12 Raped by 14 Men sell so well? To what in us are they appealing? What are they appealing to? Something he's finding appealing, apparently.
Yeah, he's finding it. You know, I'll tell you what that appeals to. Our sense of horror. That's what
it doesn't appeal to anything.
No, why would we pick up that newspaper and go, oh my gosh? We don't go, oh my gosh, that
right.
sounds good. We look at that and say, oh my good Lord,
right.
what?
The fear so instinct, it, the urgency instinct.
Right, right. The compassion instinct, mm-hmm. the horror instinct. Mm-hmm. It's not a sexual thing. So he says women for their own preservation are trying to pull themselves together, and it's necessary for all humanity that they do so. Slavishness on one hand breeds pigness on the other hand. Pigness on one hand breeds slavishness on the other. I don't even know what this means. This is kind of Marxist bullcrap.
Yeah. It's like finding a collection of words. I mean, he really was ahead of the time. This is every academic article these days about intersectionality.
In the beginning, there were strong men who killed animals and brought home the food and the dependent women who cooked it. No more. Hmm. Only the roles remain, waiting to be shaken off. There are no human oppressors. Oppressors have lost their humanity. One hand, slavishness. On the other hand, pigness. Six of one, half dozen of the other, who wins? Many women seem to be walking a tightrope now. Their qualities of love, openness, and gentleness were too deeply enmeshed with qualities of dependency, subservience, and masochism. How do you love without being dependent? How do you be gentle without being subservient? How do you maintain a relationship without giving up your identity and without getting strung out? How do you reach out and give your heart to your lover, but maintain the soul, which is you? I'm sorry. It's an old newspaper font. I will tell you this, that I do have compassion. My mother was a drug addict. She was addicted to prescription drugs towards the end of her life because she was in this middle area. She was not part of the World War II generation. And she was not part of the 1960s, you know, free love generation. She was in that generation that was the bridge between the two. So she wasn't accepted by the old people because she didn't feel comfortable there. She wasn't accepted by the young people. Don't trust anybody over 30. And yet she wanted to be herself. And I have to tell you, I have great compassion for women and men who lived through this time. My father-in-law is a great example of this. My father-in-law and my mother-in-law, both on both sides, they both grew up in typical New immigrant Italian families where the man was the man and the woman was at home making the pasta. And the men were, you know, bad. A lot of the men were bad. Not all men, but in this particular family, grandpa was not a good guy. Okay? And what the men said went. Well, my father-in-law grew up in the 1960s where, no, that was not it. So the older generation was like, what are you, a girl? You'd tell your wife exactly how it is. And well, he wasn't that guy. And he had to find that middle ground. And my mother-in-law was a woman who, you know, didn't necessarily want to stay home and be her mother. She wanted to have a life of her own. That was a nightmare to navigate, I would imagine. And they did it somehow. And so in some ways, this is what this article is saying. It's like, look, the people, men and women of that particular time and age are lost. However, what he says the old typical male is and what the new woman is wrong. It's wrong.
I mean, at the very least, every interview with Bernie Sanders should have questions about what he wrote in 1972. They should make him explain exactly what he thought and why he thought that was the way men and women were and whether he believed those things, because that's certainly the treatment that would happen to any. Can you imagine a Republican was written something like this?
Forget about it. I just explained to you a very logical way to look at this article and say, look, this is the time and this was the problem. Mm. Okay.
As long as you're deleting the first few paragraphs, you can get away with that.
I could make an argument for it. I'm not going to, cause I don't believe it, mm-hmm. but I could make an argument that would fit in that time. But nobody's going to do that for a Republican. Nobody's going to do that for a conservative. They won't do it for people who lived 200 years ago. Why should we do it for somebody who lived in 1972?
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Daily Caller just put out a video of me, and they asked me the question last week when I was in Washington, why is Donald Trump relatable? Why do so many people find him relatable? Here it is.
You have a fighter, a guy who is almost bulletproof because everybody knows, of course, it's Donald Trump. And he's taking bold, bold action. Who else does that? Who else does that?
Why is Donald Trump relatable?
I think the American people connect to Donald Trump because he is not processed. He is not somebody who has been homogenized and run through focus groups. I remember when I was at CNN, this is 2007, and Barack Obama was starting to come up in the polls. And I remember saying, the next president we have he's going to look like me, he's going to be fat, he's going to be maybe unshaven, he might have a gravy stain, he's like, oh yeah, got a gravy stain, sorry about that, listen, here's what's up. He might even fart from time to time, but he'd be just like you. We have gone from the slickest, most prepackaged president to the guy on the end of the bar stool. And it's not just that, he's also successful in the free market. And so people see him and he is an image of success. I've done it.
He may be the most eligible bachelor in America. Please welcome Donald Trump.
And he's the guy at the end of the bar stool. So it kind of gives you this, well, if he did it, I could probably do it too. So he's that. And then on top of it, because we all fart and we all know it, but we don't ever talk about it. When he talks about it, you're like, I love this guy. He farts and he says he farts. And that's refreshing because you are connecting on that level. Donald Trump is who he is. He has told the American people, you're not going to take him down. It's fun to watch the media try to take him down because people have already baked into it. They know. He's told them, I'm this guy. I'm going to do these things. And to my surprise early on, he did those things. I didn't think he was going to do those things. He did them and more. And so now you have a fighter, a guy who is almost bulletproof because everybody knows, of course, it's Donald Trump. And he's taking bold, bold action. Who else does that? Who else does that?
What do you think of that?
That's why he's relatable. Yeah. I think it's good. I think if anyone's looking to, you know, write a headline for a news story, including that video, you could go with Glenn Beck on farts, quote, that's refreshing. So if you wanted to go with that, you could. I think it's I think that's probably a pretty good summary of the way people feel about Trump, right? Like that he is that that unrefined nature that the media obviously hates so much is a big chunk of the reason why people like him.
Yeah. It was really weird. They put you in this small little room and they say, okay, you can answer one of these three questions and it needs to be about 3 minutes. And so you don't really have any time to like think about it.
Right. Right.
And so I said, I don't remember which question that was, maybe question number two. And I was like, yeah, why is he relatable? Okay.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. I'm not going to call this audience an audience anymore. This is a tribe. And I am your chief. I am your chief. And once in a while, we'll have to call a powwow. I'm just saying. I can say it because I'm how many more times?
13 times.
I'm 13 times more Native American than Elizabeth Warren. So there you go.
You're all set.
I'm all set. I am suddenly offended by cigar store Indians. I don't know why, but I'm suddenly very offended by those.
Did you always feel uneasy at that Seinfeld episode? Did it always make you squirm a little
bit? Well,
I
laughed about it, but last night things have changed.
Okay.
Things have changed for me. We have Bill Jones. He's the principal, Manatee School for the Arts. I'm sorry to bring you into this mess, Bill. He has nothing to do with the previous conversation. Bill Jones, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Glenn. I appreciate you having me on.
You bet. So how are things been? Explain what you've done with bringing veterans in.
Well, it all started when the legislature passed the bill last year that requires an armed guard on every campus, either an SRO or the new Guardian program, or you could go with private security, things like that. So the question of should you have an armed guard on campus was kind of taken out of our hands. That's not even a conversation anymore because it is required by law. So when you get to that point, you start asking the question, well, who do we want with a gun on campus, and what's the purpose? And as you follow the conversation further along, then you have to ask the question, well, what kind of gun are they going to carry? So, you know, we looked at if you're going to have somebody who, and remember that the ultimate purpose for this individual, it grows out of the Parkland shooting and previous
sure.
shootings. So they're here in the ultimate tragedy situation where you have an active shooter or, you know, assailant who comes on campus threatening faculty, staff, students, and so forth. So if you look at that far end of the spectrum, the tip of the spear, you know, and everybody likes to talk about it's a rare occurrence. And, of course, it is rare until it happens, and then nobody cares about statistics because it's very real. Ask the folks at Parkland, you know, whether the statistics mean anything at all. Doesn't matter how rare it is. It's very real. So when you look at that, one thing I said was, you know, most police officers go through their career never firing their weapon in anger, and most of them go through their career never actually having been shot at. So if we actually had an incident here I made the comment one day that I would really rather not have that be the first time that your guard had been shot at. Because
right.
I've never been in the military.
Right.
I've never been shot at. But I have talked to an awful lot of people who have. And I know that, and I've counseled some of those folks. And I know this is a very life-changing experience. You kind of figure out who you are, how you're going to respond. It's just something. And I'm thinking, you know, in the heat of the moment, I really don't want to have a situation where I have someone who has to stop for a minute and think about this or hesitate, and I don't want to get into, you know, the parkland who hesitated and so forth. But I think that's a very real concern. We have a group of individuals, and this is where we came to, who are trained. They're called combat veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them have been through this. Many of them have come out the other side better than they were before. Some of them have difficulty. We all know that. But we looked at it and said, well, you know, if we made that a criteria for hiring, then, of course, we're going to have people go through psychological evaluations.
Sure.
They go through all kinds of testing. So that's the first step in this journey, is having people who understand that in the event of a tragedy like this, they kind of have an idea of what happens and how they're going to respond. Of course, every situation is different, but at least they've been through it, and they know that it's survivable. They know there's a mission that has to be completed, and they know that it's their job to go ahead and do that, just like it was in the military.
Bill, I have to tell you, as somebody who has to have security, I just hired a new security agent, and they go through all kinds of, you know, testing and everything else before they're even coming to interview with me. And I had just really good choices in front of me. One guy who made it to the final selection had lots of military experience, but no actual combat experience. And I said to him, "How do I know that you, when the gunfire sounds, that you're going to run in or you're going to do your job?" And he said, "Well, I'm confident of that." And he made a good case, and he was a really good guy. However, I didn't have anything to show that is what, because I don't know what I would do if I'm being shot at. You can say, "Well, I'll pull my gun and I'll." No, you don't know that. Combat veterans have been through it, and they know how they're going to react. And I commend you for thinking that way. If my kid was in your school, I would breathe a lot easier knowing that you're going for tested, qualified combat vets.
Yep, that's who we're going with, and we're very comfortable. We're very confident, and this has been a long conversation. And
right.
I spent a lot of time with our chief of police here, who actually has come on our board now after all this discussion, and taking the next step, you have to look at. All these SROs, all these guardians of the training program and everything, equips them with a 9mm handgun. And our campus is quite large. We have very long hallways. It's quite an expanse across the cafeteria, things like that.
That ain't going to work.
And, you know, I love to use the analogy that if you're standing in front of our art gallery looking across the cafeteria, it's 151 feet. And I know you're a shooter.
Yep.
And next time you go to the range, try taking your 9mm shooting at 150 feet.
No, it's really hard.
Yeah, see how many targets you hit.
Yeah.
And everybody I've ever talked to, all the law enforcement, it's like they kind of chuckle about that.
Yeah.
That's not pistol range.
No.
But my problem is that I will agree that the majority of school shooters, even though it is small, the majority have come in with handguns. However, the most egregious, the most horrific, like Parkland and some of the others, they've come in with high-powered rifles.
Right.
And my concern is, for example, they're going to come in with level 3 body armor, which they're not supposed to have, but you can buy it at pawn shops anymore. So so as I look at that, you know, 150 feet, if I'm standing there with my guardian next to me and for some incredible chance an assailant were to get through that door, which you have to buzz in and everything, and get past, but if they were to get in, I have this horrible scenario in my mind that I look at the guardian and say, hey, will you run down there with your 9mm and take care of this for me? And, you know, that'd be tough for me to ask someone to do that, knowing that their probability of survival is going to be pretty slim.
So what are you arming him with?
That 150-foot shot, and I'm just using that because that's our distance, we know that it's much more capable. An AR-15, 150 feet with a decent sight on it, is a piece of cake. In fact, I've talked to my guardian, and, you know, as an expert marksman from the military, and who goes out to the range virtually every weekend to keep in shape, it's like he said, he'd have to try not to make a shot like that.
Yeah, that's
an easy shot. And that's my concern, that why would you ask, if you're going to ask someone to put their life on the line to guard you, why would you ask them to use tools that are not as effective as other tools? And guns are tools in this situation.
So talking to Bill Jones, principal Manatee School for the Arts, that has hired veterans now for security, and he's not handing them a 9mm handgun. What are you handing them?
Well, actually, they do carry a 9mm sidearm.
Okay.
But in addition to that, we wanted a high-powered rifle, and quite frankly, we wanted something a little shorter than a standard AR, because you're in an urban setting, hallways. You don't need a big barrel hanging out there swinging around. So I looked into short barrel rifles, and I have an attorney who specializes in gun law and so forth, and she did quite a bit of research. And the problem is, as a charter school, we're a 501c3 here in Florida, and to purchase NFA Class 3 weapons is a little bit of a nightmare in terms of the paperwork.
Oh, my gosh.
And having your board members and involved and all that. It's not just a simple trust like an individual would do. So we rankled with that for a while. And I said, well, let's just go with a bullpup. We'll get the full length of the barrel. We'll get the shorter gun. And let's see what's available. We looked around a little bit. And quite frankly, we were very impressed with this new Kel-Tec RDB-17.
Good gun.
Which is chambered in .223 or .556, and the military round. It's a very short gun, but it maintains a 17-inch barrel for accuracy and so forth.
So now you are...
And it hangs across the front. Of course, our Guardian's pretty tall, hefty guy. But it hangs very nicely. It doesn't protrude beyond the person. Mm-hmm. It's if you're not used to guns at all, it's probably any rifle is going to be visually intimidating. But as compared to a standard AR-15, something like that, it's not nearly as visually intimidating. But it also makes it easy to carry around. It's gotten great reviews. My guardian tells me that he's put about 4,500 rounds through it. It's performed flawlessly for him.
So let me ask you,
because it's slightly different from the AR platform.
What is
it's
the
downward ejection? It's an ambidextrous weapon.
It's like all of a sudden, are you doing a commercial for Kel-Tec here? For hang on just a second. Let me ask you this, Bill. What's the response? Have you gotten pushback on this, Bill?
Pushback. There are several levels that you get pushback from. I've gotten emails from groups. It was horrible because they were all form emails. And I said, hey, do you have anything original to say, or do you just want to tell me what the leader of your group has to say? And they were basically people who are opposed to guns, period.
Mm-hmm.
No guns in schools. Okay, well, that's great.
Thank you.
I don't have a choice. I've got to have a gun in school.
Mm-hmm.
Then the vast majority, I would say, of parents, I've gotten a lot of email from around the country, especially from vet groups. You can imagine how pleased they are that we're doing this. But it's been overwhelmingly positive. I have had some pushback from some gun snobs who have dissed the Kel-Tec and said, "Now you need a true military weapon." come on.
I know, gun people are a little like libertarians, man. Hey, we just love all guns, except that one. That's
on the head of a pin.
It's, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of very esoteric.
Yeah. Yeah.
We did have, I had someone comments like, oh, it makes it look like war. That was an older gentleman. And I said, well, here, we're talking reality here. We're not talking about we wish things could be different. And I made the point, and it's awful, that if somebody comes in with a gun and starts shooting, it is war. There's blood, there's dead people, there's bodies. It is war. And if you're not prepared for that, then you're not going to get the outcome that you're looking for.
Bill?
You know, everybody talks to me, like I say, about the statistics. Oh, this is a very rare occurrence. Of course it is.
Good. Let's keep it that way.
Yeah. And I use the analogy of the lotto. You know, what are the odds of winning the lotto? 1 in 14 million, 1 in 30 million. But, you know, every week or two or a month or so, oh, my goodness, somebody wins the lotto.
Right.
And like I say, for those people, those group statistics are meaningless to the individual when it happens.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true of school shootings. Every school that's ever had a school shooting, you're going to hear the same thing. Gosh, we never thought that would happen here.
Right. It always is that case. Bill, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. Thank you for standing up and being logical and reasonable about all of this. And I think being on radio programs and television programs and everything else is actually going to help your students because you're sending out the message, we are not a safe zone. We're not a gun-free zone. We take this seriously, and you want to kill somebody, we're going to kill you first. Thank you so much, Bill. Appreciate it.
Bill sounds like a great guy. I can't imagine how long the announcements go on every morning, though. I feel like you might not get to any classes. I feel like, he's awesome, though. That's great.
You're listening to the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
In just a few days, on Saturday, there is something called the Day of Mourning. Now, this was happening in New York. It was happening in Albany. And it was started by Elizabeth Johnston. Now, she was on the program with us last week. And now there are 20 more cities where this has started to spread. Elizabeth joins us now. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Very good. I just want to introduce you. Elizabeth is a speaker and an author and a vlogger, and she has been involved in all kinds of things, but mainly raising her 10 children. Some things have happened in life where she said, enough is enough, not on my watch. And she has now become a very big, powerful voice in social media. And has written a new book called Not on My Watch, but we want to talk to her about the Day of Mourning. So what's happened since last we spoke, Elizabeth?
Glenn, partially thanks to being on your show last week, we could not be more excited about the response to the Day of Mourning. As you mentioned, we are now simulcasting the event to 21 cities. Days ago, we had sold out of our venue space at the convention center. We are scrambling to rent more rooms at the convention center to simulcast. I think we'll have at least 5,000 people at the convention center in Albany, New York, and probably standing outside. We have tapped into something, Glenn. People want to be anywhere they can be near the Day of Mourning because we are standing in the gap and interposing for our nation on Saturday. We believe the blood of these babies is crying up to God right now, and we are in deep trouble. And we've seen in history times when people have stood in the gap for their nation and God has spared their nation, like when Moses stood in the gap for the Hebrew people and God spared them, and Esther stood in the gap and called for fasting and prayer when Haman wanted to destroy her people and God spared them. That is the heart of what we are doing on Saturday, and people just want to get as close to it as they possibly can.
All right, so you have events now in Apple Valley, California, Eugene, Oregon. Wow, that's shocking to me. Is Eugene normal? I mean, sorry to say that. Sorry, Oregon, but you know what I'm talking about. Chicago, Illinois, Charlotte, North Carolina. Where else?
Oh, you can, if you go to the dayofmourning.org, you will see the 21 cities where we are simulcasting. scroll to the bottom of the website, dayofmourning.org, and you will see that we are just in tons of states and super excited about that. I think people, Glenn, they are tired of the half measures that we have been taking. When are we going to see that these half measures aren't working? You know, when you cut branches off a tree, the branches are going to grow back, right? And the pro-aborts are always coming back with more and more bloodshed, more and more outrageous legislation. And the pro-life movement has been strangely fixated on passing pathetic legislation that says, you know, you can kill the baby as long as the doctor has hospital privileges, or you can kill the baby as long as you let the mom wait 24 hours, or you can kill the baby as long as the clinic is sanitary. Are we out of our minds? Glenn, what if we said that back in the Holocaust time about the Jewish people? Okay, you can kill Jews as long as the clinic is sanitary.
So,
have mercy. Like, no, we need to end the killing. And that's why this is a vertical response on Saturday, Glenn. It's saying, you know what? We have all just been completely negligent and complicit in this crime of child killing, and we've got to make this right with God.
All right, so this is the thing I like about this. This is not a thing where everybody gets up and gives a speech, or, you know, and you're cheering and you bringing signs. You're asking people to, on Saturday, not to shop, to close your business if you're a business owner, to wear black in mourning, and repent for the sin of abortion and ask for God's protection. So at these events, what you're going to see is what exactly, Elizabeth?
You will hear inspiring testimonies and stories from, for instance, a mother who chose life because Christians were there to help her choose life when she was heading into the abortion clinic. You'll hear from an 8-year-old abortion survivor who was adopted and is just a beautiful young woman. You'll hear from Black conservative David J. Harris, who's going to deal with what a problem this is in the Black community and how they have killed off so much of their race. But more than speakers, you're going to hear us all praying, seeking God, crying out to God for mercy. This is a prayer meeting. This is a sober time of repentance. We are standing in the gap for our nation. And Glenn, I just cannot thank you enough for partnering with us in this and helping us get the word out.
Elizabeth, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's very brave and high time. And what I like about this movement is it isn't about people, and it isn't about parties or elections. It's really about what I believe is a covenant that we made with God, and we have broken that covenant. And if we don't cry out to Him and beg for forgiveness, if He doesn't hear from us, we are going to be destroyed. We are going to be destroyed because I firmly believe with the technology and the ingenuity that we have as Americans, if we go dark, we are going to be the worst nation ever on the in history. We are going to make the Nazis look like rookies. With what we have now in technology, we can kill millions of people overnight. And it can all be done in the cover of darkness in their own home. And nobody will ever see it because we can cut off all communication. I mean, it's horrifying to think. And we are strangely no longer moved. It's, you know, the man's love for man has waxed cold.
Yeah, think about this, Glenn. Think about the passion that the left has for their ideas and the lack of passion that we have for ours. The potheads will defy the feds for their marijuana, state after state after state, but we don't even have enough love for our preborn neighbor to defy the feds when they tell us it's okay to execute babies in cold blood. This is why we're meeting on Saturday, because something has happened to our hearts. We are dead inside to an issue that should so greatly alarm us that we can't sleep at night, an issue that would cause us, yes, to defy the feds, to say, I don't care what Roe v. Wade says. Roe v. Wade can kiss my grits. I'm going to protect these babies. And we don't have that, Glenn. And so that's why we are seeking God to change our hearts on Saturday.
Elizabeth Johnston, she's the author of the book, ActivistMommy.com. It's the day of mourning that is happening this Saturday. I cannot urge you strongly enough, no matter what your faith is, please turn your eyes to God and beg for forgiveness and help and time so we can correct the sins that we have just let happen on our watch. And I know, you know, I'm not talking to anybody about repenting. I have so much repenting to do. I have said so many times in my career, and especially at the times when I was at Fox, we were under attack on so many different things. And people came to me and said, you got to talk about abortion and life. And I said, are you kidding me? I can carry no more water. Somebody else has to carry that bucket because I just can't carry any more water. And I regret that deeply. And we can all make excuses, but in the end, those excuses don't mean anything. This is a Holocaust that has happened in our country. And those of us who say we are against this, we do have to stand in peace, in love, with compassion. And we should take the beam out of our own eye first before we look for the beams in other people's eyes. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you, Glenn. God bless you.
Dayofmourning.org. It's Day of Mourning, and that's with a U. Dayofmourning.org. It is this Saturday.
This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
So I want to talk a little bit about, something that I found interesting today about the inside scoop of Cortez and the way AOC, I hate that so much.
It's painful.
It really is.
It is. It's painful. They just are trying to make her a thing so badly for different reasons. I think every like mainstream analysis of her is completely wrong. Like the typical way you look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is, at least the way the media does, she's this energetic superstar, up and coming future of the Democratic Party that is lit everything on fire. It's amazing. And the Republicans are obsessed with her because they're afraid of her.
I love it.
Yeah, and I think both of them though are wrong. I mean, the bat, we talked about the idea that Republicans are only bringing her up. If you think about the goals of Republicans in election cycles for the past, let's say, 70 years, it's been try to show that Democrats are socialists, right? And that will scare a voter from voting for them, right? Like being honest about, like, you might think if you're a Democrat, oh, they're not all socialists. But the Republican goal has been to paint Democrats that way. They give us a lot of help, right? Like many of them support so many policies that are the same. But it's been a hard task. For the example of Barack Obama this recently, when we were saying like, hey, this guy has a lot of socialist tendencies, we were called racist and haters. We were throwing out these evil, awful accusations at this president.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
they're
embracing it. They're calling themselves socialists.
It's almost like they took off their masks.
So, yeah, exactly. As you pointed out back in the day. And so the idea that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Republicans, are afraid of her, it's the exact opposite. She is giving them what they've tried to accomplish for 70 years. They are finally saying, yes, Democrats are socialists, and we're telling you that we are.
And
that's a gift to Republicans.
It is. In fact, let me play the audio from Bernie Sanders, where he just said, look, you know, just a few years ago, nobody wanted to say that they were a socialist. Now, that's what the party has embraced. Listen to this.
Many of the ideas that I talked about, Medicare for all, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, making public colleges and universities tuition free, all of those ideas, people say, oh, Bernie, they're so radical. They are extreme. The American people just won't accept those ideas. Well, you know what's happened in over 3 years? All of those ideas and many more are now part of the political mainstream.
So you're saying the party came your way?
Well, I don't want to say that. I think most people would say that.
And the numbers show that as well.
Right.
538 did a study on this and showed, yeah. Or no, it was CNN that did it. CNN said, yeah, by the way, this is the most liberal field in history.
Right. So what was wrong in the media, what the media said, oh, how dare you, you racist, say this, that these people are socialist. You're just throwing nasty names around. We're like, that's not a nasty name. It's not a racist thing. It's a political ideology that has been tried all around the world over and over again. Well, you just want to. No, I'm just telling you that's what they believe. Well, they do believe that. And now they're embracing it. So the right should celebrate that they are now embracing this, because we can have at least an honest conversation. I mean, my love for a campaign between two people last time in 16 was Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, let America make a decision.
Yeah,
right?
Have an honest, open debate. Bernie Sanders is open and honest. I am not for the Constitution being the way it is. I want to reverse and have a second Bill of Rights. And I want to make this a document that says these are the things the government must do. And Ted Cruz believes in the Constitution the way it is and says, no, these are the things the government must never do. Let's have that conversation and just get done with it. Let's just get on with it. But they didn't want to have that debate. Now we can have that debate, and we're on the winning side of this. We're on the winning side. Now, we look at Ocasio-Cortez, and the media says, oh, we're just afraid of her. No, we're not. And quite honestly, neither is the left. Now, I want you to know, there are two Democratic parties right now. There's the hip Democrats, like Ocasio-Cortez, and then there's the hip replacement Democrats. And the hip replacement Democrats, we all know who they are. It's Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and everybody else. Mm-hmm. Well, and kind of Bernie Sanders, except he's actually in both categories.
He actually fits probably more in the hip Democrats.
Yes.
The same way like you would have put Ron Paul in the hip Republicans back in the day.
Yes.
Like, even though he might be older, he fits more of that brand.
Right. He was a rebel.
Right.
He was a rebel. Mm-hmm. And he's such a rebel that he's gone back to being a Democrat to run for the presidential candidacy in the Democratic Party, although he's always an independent. And now he's going after independents like Howard Schultz, because you got to join the party. You got to be part of the party.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy. Anyway, so there's these two groups. And these two groups are really looked at as crazies. And I believe, I've wondered, why is Nancy Pelosi and why are these people just allowing Ocasio-Cortez just to do this? Just to take out, a talking point memo, quote unquote, and say we're going to get rid of cars and we're going to get airplanes and everything else. Why are they allowing her to do this? I actually think I figured it out. Last night on the TV show, we went over the Green New Deal, and I want to bring you the highlights of that show and show you I actually think she's a pathetic figure now. I really do. I think she's a really sad, pathetic figure that has no idea how she's being used by the hip replacement Democrats.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.